And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, this hour we begin with Candida Moss, Dr. Candida Moss. She's the author of The Myth of Persecution, How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom. She's a professor of New Testament and Early Christianity at the University of Notre Dame. And she joins us by phone from South Bend, Indiana. Welcome to you, Doctor.
Thank you so much for having me.
And welcome, Doctor. You being a person of faith, a Catholic, would this book be considered heresy?
Well, this isn't heresy. It's not about doctrine, so it's not considered sort of blasphemy or heresy. But it's still a very sensitive topic for Catholics, and certainly, you know, I am a practicing Catholic, so I knew that up front, but it has elicited a fairly strong responses from some.
Any flack, considering you're a professor at Notre Dame, one of the nation's leading religious universities?
Yeah, I get a lot of emails from and letters from people who feel that I should probably resign or something.
So what was life actually like for the Christians under the Romans? Weren't they targeted and persecuted for practicing their faith and not conforming to Roman law?
Well, they were occasionally. There were periods when the Romans really did turn their attention to Christians and enact legislation and take steps to target Christians and persecute them. But that didn't happen for the first three centuries of the Christian era. That happened for about 10 years out of those three centuries. Now, Christians probably felt socially marginalized during the rest of the time because they were very different from other people. They most of them refused to join the military. They wouldn't swear oaths, which meant that they couldn't sort of participate in many aspects of ancient society. So they couldn't, you know, complete business transactions properly, for example. They also... They sort of felt that marriage was sort of a bad idea, that you should really dedicate your life to Jesus rather than getting married and having big families. So they were seen as sort of undermining the traditional Roman family, which is dreadfully ironic. And
in light of today.
Yeah, in light of today, that they were the ones who were undermining the family in the ancient world. And they said there were rumors about them, sort of their secret ritual. So we know that brotherly love is sort of something you feel for your fellow Christians. And we know that now that sort of the Eucharist is bread and wine, but there were rumors that Christians were sort of partaking in cannibalism and incest. And you can see why, if you just overheard someone talking about brotherly love or eating the body of Jesus, you might think that something more sinister was going on. So they were sort of social outcasts. People didn't like them. And they were sort of very suspicious to the Romans because they didn't really participate in society and wouldn't support the structures that were keeping the empire in place. But they weren't being persecuted. And so the story that people grow up with, that I grew up with, about being hunted down in the catacombs and having to go into hiding, that's just not true. That's a later idea.
How did you determine that these early texts are historically inaccurate?
Well, actually, this process, historians have been looking at these texts for hundreds of years, Catholic priests themselves, and have known that there were problems with many of the stories. There are supposed to be thousands of martyrs, but beginning in the Reformation, Catholic priests started looking at the stories and determined that some of Christianity's most beloved saints may never have existed at all, and certainly that the things that we think about them just aren't true. So St. Christopher, or St. Christopher medals that people wear, never existed. And so I'm hardly the first. I'm trying to communicate to people who aren't scholars what scholars already know, because there's a lot of sort of misinformation out there. And when you look at these stories and you see people mentioning ideas that don't exist for hundreds of years after the events, or you see references to sort of ideas that come out of ancient pagan literature, or the whole story seems to copy the death of Jesus sort of a little too precisely, or you see identical stories with different saints' names plugged in, then you start to get suspicious. And as a historian, you sort of want to look into this and investigate and wonder.
So Ben-Hur and Spartacus was hogwash, right?
Yeah, I mean, there was a Spartacus, a historical Spartacus, but he didn't necessarily know any Christians.
So what purpose did the early Christians have to invent these stories of martyrdom and sainthood?
Right. Well, these stories are incredibly captivating. You know, these are stories of heroism and bravery, of ordinary Christians sort of overcoming their lot in life to sort of champion Christ and fight injustice and Satan. And they're full of sort of miracles and sort of witty banter between the martyr and the judge and sort of heroic bravery. And so people love these stories, and they were just sort of really interesting to hear. But the reason why people sort of expanded them wasn't just because people liked hearing them. It was also because wealthy Christians wanted to go visit the places that saints had died. And they took with them a lot of money. And so if you were an enterprising young priest in a small town that really didn't have a lot going for it, you could lure people to your town to, you know, come visit the shrines of our saints, come see where they died, come drink our wine, come spend your money. And so there was a good economic reason to try and get people to believe that there were martyrs that had never existed.
So that was the predominant reason, economic reasons?
Well, there were economic reasons. There were also sort of doctrinal reasons. You know, martyrs are heroes, and who doesn't sort of naturally take to the opinions of their heroes? And so other Christians would use martyrs to say, look, there's this heresy out there, and I heard that this martyr denounced that heretic and said that he was from Satan. And we have examples of this, and we can see people writing these stories and inserting them into legends. And it's sort of a little bit like sort of brand marketing. So now your favorite athlete endorses a brand of soda, and you want to go drink that brand of soda. If you're an early Christian and you're trying to really push your brand of early Christianity and make sure that people don't fall into heresy, then you say, well, your favorite martyr endorsed my brand of Christianity. He was Orthodox like me, or he was a heretic like me. And you write the story and you share it with people and you hope that people agree with you, because a great story is worth 100 powerful logical arguments.
We're speaking with Dr. Candida Moss. She's a professor of New Testament and Early Christianity at the University of Notre Dame. And the author, the name of the book that she authored, The Myth of Persecution, How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom. On Topical Currents today, if you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-9576. Or you can email radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. So, Dr. Moss, what would be the purpose for contemporary Christians to perpetuate this tradition of martyrs?
Well, part of the reason is just that this is our tradition and it's easy to draw upon. But we use martyrs rhetorically in the same way as we always have done. The way that sort of persecution rhetoric works is if you're persecuted, you're innocent. And the people who are persecuting you, they don't have a legitimate complaint. They just hate you. And so you should fight them and resist them. Christians today who find themselves maybe on the losing end of certain cultural and social battles feel that they're being persecuted. And they employ this idea. They say, we're like the martyrs. Just as Christians have always been persecuted, just as they were in the early church, we are persecuted today. And that's rhetorically powerful because it tugs on that idea that Christians are innocent and that their ideas are supported by God and that those who disagree with them are acting for evil, for Satan. They're just wrong. And no doubt Christians who express this sentiment really feel that way. They really feel under attack, and they're looking back to a better time when they called the shots in society. And it does feel worse. But this idea that Christians are always persecuted, that comes to us from the early church. And were it not for these sort of myths of persecution from the early church, Christians today wouldn't be able to just say we're being persecuted just like we always have been, and people should do what we say.
How does martyrdom and the promise of afterlife figure in with your premise?
Yeah, what's interesting is, and I hear this from my students a lot, they tell me that, you know, Christian martyrs, they died just because they loved Jesus. Whereas, say, for example, Muslim martyrs, they tell me, they die because of the virgins in heaven. And Christians didn't have that motivation, therefore Christian martyrs are just better. And I understand and empathize with that sentiment that if you're doing it for a reward, somehow your motives seem less good, we might say. But when you look at the evidence, early Christians thought that if they died as martyrs, they went directly to heaven. Everyone else has to wait for the final judgment, which hasn't happened yet. And the martyrs are very pragmatic about it. One of the early Christian martyrs, his name is Polycarp, he says that, you know, he will happily exchange an hour of torment for an eternity in heaven. This idea of like, well, martyrdom is relatively brief. It takes a couple of hours. Maybe you'll be tortured for a few days. But when you put that torment against the fires of hell, you can see why promises of eternal life and going directly to heaven when you die, how that becomes really compelling and almost like sort of, well, why wouldn't you want to die as a martyr? It's got to be the best death that's out there.
We're speaking with Dr. Kendra Moss, and the name of her book is The Myth of Persecution. We need to take a short break. Please stay with us, and we'll be right back.
You can find Topical Currents on Facebook, a dedicated page with daily program descriptions, links to our guests, authors, and books. Facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we're back, 20 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and we're speaking with Dr. Kendra Moss. She's the author of The Myth of Persecution, How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom. Let's take a quick phone call. This is Frank in Weston. Hi.
Hello.
Frank, go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. Am I on the air?
Yes.
Oh, yes. My question on today's topic is the following. I understand that the word martyr in Latin is announcer, that these early Christians were announcing the gospel or the teachings of Christ. So at one point the connection was made that the word announcer in Latin is actually the word martyr, which will indicate that they actually were martyrs or they were punished and mistreated. So I wonder if there's an explanation to that.
Professor?
Yeah, well, the word martyr actually comes from Greek, and you're right, it doesn't necessarily mean someone who dies. Originally, it meant a witness, as in a courtroom witness, which, of course, Christians were when they ended up dying because they gave testimony and evidence in a courtroom. Therefore, they were witnesses in the courtroom. And I think, you know, people who go to church will often hear this, you know, martyr means witness. And yes, they are witnessing to their faith. But if the idea is that Christians were being persecuted, which means that the Romans were actually targeting them for being Christians, that's the idea that I would say is flawed. Christians weren't constantly persecuted. Now, were they witnesses? Sure they were. Did their witness sometimes lead them to situations that led for them to die? Yes. But were the Romans like trying to get the Christians, enacting constant legislation against them? Were they being sought out in their homes? Were people coming to their houses to arrest them? No, those things seem not to have happened. In fact, we have evidence that the earliest Roman emperor to comment on Christians says that Christians are not to be sought out. They're not to be hounded.
What about the Edict of Decius? Didn't that target Christians?
Well, this is what's interesting. We thought for nearly 2,000 years, we thought that Decius enacted an edict against Christians, forcing them to sacrifice. But then we discovered sort of archaeological evidence of what had actually happened, because we didn't actually have Decius's edict. And when we looked at that evidence, it became clear that the edict wasn't about Christians. It was about everyone. What Decius wanted was for everyone to participate in the imperial cult. Now, instantly, as moderns, we think, well, if you have to, you know, offer sacrifice, which is just sprinkling some grain in a flame and some incense, then surely that's, you know, you can't recognize other religions, other gods, other deities. And that's what we think. But the imperial cult at the time was sort of a way of enacting political order and social unity. It was sort of like a pledge of allegiance that we would say today. And Christians refused to do that, and Christians were really the first to refuse to do that. And the Decian Edict wasn't targeting Christians, it was just trying to revivify the practice of demonstrating political allegiance to the emperor in the imperial cult, because at the time, the imperial household felt very vulnerable. Decius felt like he was sort of under attack and he was fairly vulnerable. So no, it was never about Christians. It was about political and social uniformity.
David in North Miami Beach wants to know if early Christians were in trouble because they were no longer Jews who had a truce with Rome.
Yeah, that definitely was a factor. So the Jews were viewed as this sort of ancient group, and everyone knew you couldn't make the Jews do things without them being willing to lay down their lives. So the Jews were handled with kid gloves to some extent. That said, there's archaeological evidence that there was imperial cult in ancient Palestine, which means that the Jews had negotiated a way for them to offer prayers for the emperor without compromising their own position. But Christians had sort of broken away from the Jews, and they were actively evangelizing. So the Jews weren't going out there and trying to get other people to join Judaism.
Right.
But the Christians were, and the Romans didn't even see the Christians as a religion. They described them as a superstition. And a superstition, the word in Latin, when they used it, it doesn't mean sort of like, well, I don't really think you're religious. I think that's superstitious. Although it does mean that, it also means sort of insanity. So they thought that the Christians were spreading this sort of insane religious condition to other people. They didn't think, oh, it's a religion, they have beliefs. And so the Romans were pretty concerned about this sort of insane superstition that was being spread. And while they weren't targeting Christians, they would, if Christians were stubborn and obstinate and broke the law, they would execute them.
Once again, how does the legacy of martyrdom translate in the 21st century?
Right. Well, we'll often hear politicians, church leaders, media pundits talk about how there's a war on Christians, there's a war on Easter,
Christmas.
There's a war on Christmas. Christians are being persecuted. Rick Santorum said there was a jihad against him. There's a lot of this language being bandied about, and modern Christians talk about how they're persecuted in America for the inability to say prayer in public schools, or for new social movements that want to change the law in America. And they see that as an attack on them. And, you know, in almost all cases, these social movements, these legislation, are not about Christians. They're about other sets of concerns. But Christians are interpreting them as an attack on Christianity and expressing their relationship to other people as one as of persecutor and persecutee. The government is persecuting me. And that's problematic because it means that there can be no dialogue between people who disagree about how society should be run, be it prayer in public schools or contraception or gay marriage or whatever the case is. Once you describe those things as persecution, then you're not going to listen to what the other side has to say, and you're not going to be able to come to sort of common agreement in which your religious liberties are protected, but other people's civil liberties are protected too.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you're not saying that there was never prejudice against Christians or there were no Christian saints or martyrs. You're just saying that they weren't persecuted to the extent that we've been led to believe.
Right. They weren't persecuted constantly. And that's the idea that sort of stuck, the idea that Christians are by their very nature persecuted. They were persecuted in the early church, and they've been persecuted ever since, and they're persecuted today. And if you look at history, it's clear we haven't constantly been persecuted. I mean, there's a very long period after the rise of the Emperor Constantine to sort of modern secularization, in which Christians really called the shots and even were persecuted themselves. But it's this early history that's giving substance to the idea that Christians are persecuted today, when in America, they're not.
How would you respond to those who might have a difficult time with your book, with reading it or with the content of it?
Right. Well, I would say in the first place, when I wrote the book, I didn't write it to say that no one's being persecuted today. There are people in other parts of the world who are being persecuted, and they need our help. So I would say that in the first place. I would say, so far as the history goes, yes, it's really difficult to realize that sort of cherished traditions aren't true. That's difficult to hear. But because this idea has been pervasive and because it wields power today, it's important that we face up to the limitations of the evidence, and it's important that we get our facts straight.
Do you think that these myths, as you call them, detract from the real instances of persecution today?
Yes, I do. And you can just see that in reporting of language of persecution. So one of the examples I give in my book is of a day in January 2012, and it was a day when Newt Gingrich talked about how he was running for the Republican presidential nomination because there was a war on Christianity in America and he wanted to fight in that war. Which is a remarkable thing to say, like there's a civil war in America and I'm running for president of the United States, but I'm just going to represent one party. But on that day, there was also a report of 35,000 Christians in Nigeria being driven out of their homes and their villages being burned. That report got hardly any media coverage in the U.S., whereas Newt Gingrich's lines, and I realize, you know, it's an election year, he's a very important American figure, but the language of persecution being employed here in America overshadows those instances in other places in the world. And that's a problem. That's a really big problem. And we can even see people, maybe not deliberately, but sort of exploiting persecution around the world in order to fortify their own position in America. So they'll say things like, there's a global war on Christians. And then they'll say, and we need to fight that here in America. Well, you know, that's not really the case. And where we would need to combat persecution would be in other countries. And finally, I would say that when the sort of historical context into which we place those instances of persecution around the world is the historical context of good versus evil and God versus Satan and Christianity against everyone else, then we're not allowing for the reality of persecution against other religious groups.
Well, Dr. Candida Moss, she's a professor of New Testament and Early Christianity at the University of Notre Dame. The author of many books, the latest is The Myth of Persecution, How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom. We want to thank you so much being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez and South Florida author Brad Meltzer up next. Stay with us. And we're back with today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with you. In his new thriller, The Fifth Assassin, Miami resident Brad Meltzer imagines a hunt for a psychopath who's obsessed with following in the footsteps of the four men who successfully killed American presidents. Set in the near future, the copycat plans to take down the president at one of the country's most beloved landmarks. As in Meltzer's other novels, history plays a pivotal role. The subject has always fascinated this best-selling author, who also hosts Brad Meltzer's Decoded, a TV show on the History Channel, which investigates conspiracy theories throughout the centuries. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Meltzer. He began by asking about the laxness of presidential security in the past.
You know, I can't speak for all of history, but I can tell you at certain points, depending on where you want to draw the past, Abraham Lincoln, no security, right? He had one guy who's a policeman who goes and gets a drink next door as John Wilkes Booth comes into Ford's Theater. That's called really bad lax security. You can go to fast forward to McKinley, And basically, they still don't have the Secret Service guarding the president. They may have the Secret Service, but not guarding the president. It's not until two presidents die that they finally realize, you know what, we need a little more help here. And then, even then, after McKinley, they learn, you know what, we probably shouldn't bring him out in these kind of group one-on-one sessions, because he gets killed actually at almost the equivalent of a World's Fair. And a long line is waiting for him, and they're all coming in one by one. And I think for when you look at JFK, they, you know, it seems safer because he's not touching anyone's hands. And who knew that, you know, there in the book depository, someone was going to take a long-range shot. So each death, sadly, of course, affects security. Today, though, it's pretty amazing what goes on and what people don't even see. There are things that the government does right now, some of the things you see in the novel, but like penetration testing, where the government goes out, hires its own people to penetrate its own buildings. So they'll take a real live person. There's a guy right now who has a job. I know who he is, and goes to break into the White House. And he'll have a target. Can you get in? And however he gets in, he tries to penetrate inside. And however he gets in, they kind of close that loop and try and figure out how. So we are constantly, as a government, testing and retesting all of our security on a regular basis, which is, of course, how it should be.
Well, there hasn't. Fortunately, there hasn't been a president assassinated since 50 years.
No. Listen, this is why we don't even – to me, it's like we don't want to tempt fate. But, yeah, it's been a good run. We've had a good run. I mean, Reagan did.
The last attempted assassination was 30 years ago.
No, but that's not – there's actually – I mean, it just depends what you count. Bush even said that he was, you know, supposedly poisoned in Germany and or wherever he was. Remember?
Really?
Yeah, Bush W. said that. And I think in his memoirs, he said that there was a point with someone they thought poisoned him. And people took there were a number of people. A guy tried to fly an airplane onto the White House when Clinton was president. Someone shot at the White House when Clinton was president. And in fact, it was wild because when I was researching the novel, you know, here I am. It's a novel that's about a serial killer who's recreating the crimes of all the assassins from John Wilkes Booth to Lee Harvey Oswald, right? I make that up. That's total fiction. And as I'm researching the book, the guy who actually took a shot at the Clinton White House when he was driving to D.C. drove down to Dallas and went by the book depository. Apparently went on the tour, someone told me recently. And then he went and stayed at the Hinckley Hilton where John Hinckley shot Ronald Reagan. And here I was researching the book, and I'm like, I made that plot up. And no, I didn't. It was actually happening in real life. There was a guy who was kind of following the footsteps.
Well, you said that your novel imagines an attempt on a fictional president's life and that this would-be assassin is obsessed with the four men who actually did kill American presidents. Most people have heard of Lincoln's killer, John Wilkes Booth, and JFK's killer, Lee Harvey Oswald. What about the other two? Who were they?
Yeah, no, their press agents were not nearly as good as Oswald and as John Wilkes Booth. But when you look at McKinley's killer, was named Leon Czolgosz, and Garfield's killer was named Charles Guiteau. And both of them, I will say, are equally crazy as Booth was and as Lee Harvey Oswald was. And in fact, one of the things and of course I put this in the book because I love – you know me. I love to do the research. I love to show it. And I found out that when Czolgosz was arrested, he shot famously McKinley by – he's in a long line, waiting in line. He has the gun in his hand and he has a handkerchief over his hand to hide the gun. So when he goes to shake the president's hand, it looks like his hand is bandaged or with a handkerchief over it. And then he shoots him through the handkerchief, which catches fire, and everyone starts screaming. But what he does in the jail cell afterwards is he keeps taking it. He requests a handkerchief, and he takes it off of his hand. He folds it up, then he unfolds it, and he puts it over his hand again. And then he takes it off, and he folds it up, and then he unfolds it, and he puts it over his hand again. And he's just a whack job, right? I mean, and so to me, when I'm writing the book, usually I'm trying to make up the crazy. That's the fun, right? You got to make it up. With this, I didn't have to because I can have my character, once I tell the story to the readers, when my assassin is basically taking a handkerchief and folding it up and unfolding it and putting it over his hand, you know exactly what he's going to do. And to me, it's the greatest of all Hitchcock quotes, which is, you know, it's not the bang that's scary. It's the anticipation of it.
Right. It's the bomb under the table.
That's it. That's the Gore Vidal one.
We're speaking with Brad Meltzer about his new novel, The Fifth Assassin. A scene in your novel takes place at Walter Reed's Army Medical Museum. What gruesome exhibits are stored at the museum?
Yeah, you know, the whole novel came from a visit there. It really did. I knew I wanted to do something about assassins, and for years now, better part of a decade, but I couldn't think of the link. And I didn't want to just do it because it sounds cool. You want to actually come up with something that makes sense, and then you'll have a better story. And so a longtime reader said, why don't you come down to the museum in Washington, D.C. that almost nobody knows about? I work there. And I was like, well, what do you have there? And he said to me, well, I have pieces of Abraham Lincoln's skull. We have the bones of John Wilkes Booth. And we have the bullet that actually killed Abraham Lincoln. Would you like to come see it? I was like, yes, I want to come see that, right? You want to go do that. So I went there. And the amazing part was they didn't just have the Lincoln assassination artifacts, but they had pieces from the others as well. So he opened up a drawer for me. And they were all almost as if you took a human skeleton and you just put it in a drawer. There's a big femur and there's arms and legs and everything else, ribs. And I said, what's that? And he said, meet President Garfield. And there was, I guess, the bones of President Garfield in this drawer. Then he pulls up another one.
The president's bones were there?
I don't ask me why. I know he's buried elsewhere. Yeah. I can't explain. I don't, but, and I'll explain you why they have all these items because that's actually interesting. And then he opens up another one and there's a jar. And he pulls out a jar with like a jelly jar with a spongy material in it. And I say, what's that? And he says, that is the brain of Charles Guiteau. You are now holding in your hand. And anyone that gives you a brain is like, to me, the number one person you want to invite to your party, right? I mean, this guy, he has fun. But the reason that the museum has these items is because years ago, back during the Civil War, if someone got shot and you died, they would say, well, why did he die? Why did Ariel die? And they would cut your arm off and they would ship it to this – it was not a museum then. It was a research facility for the Army. And they would say, figure out why he died. Was there a vein in his arm that's so vital that lets you live? They were trying to literally figure out why we die. And sure enough, of course, as time develops, they realize you're not dying. Germ theory develops. And they realize what you're dying from is not a bullet wound because of some lost vein. You're dying because of an infection, blood poisoning. That's why you're dying. And that's why when your arm gets shot, you die. And what they did is they had all these pieces. So they have pieces of Abraham Lincoln's skull. They have the Booth things. They have the Guiteau brain. And the reason that they have it all is because it was for research. And then when the research was basically done and they knew the body part stuff, they didn't know what to do with it. So they said, okay, now instead of a research facility, you're a museum. And the guy said to me, the Smithsonian got Dorothy's ruby red slippers. We got everyone's body parts.
Well, your new novel, The Fifth Assassin, is a sequel to your last novel, The Inner Circle. Briefly, tell us about The Inner Circle.
Yeah, you know, a few years ago, I got a call from the Department of Homeland Security who asked me to come in and brainstorm different ways that terrorists could attack the United States, which was a ridiculous thing to do and really fun and really humbling. But I was struck by why'd they call me, why an ordinary citizen? And I traced it back through history, and it traced back to George Washington, had his own private spy ring. And he used to use regular people. It was made up of regular people because all of his top people in the Army kept getting intercepted. Their letters kept getting intercepted. And he said, you know what, give me regular ordinary citizens because no one will look twice at them. And I said, you know what, wouldn't it be cool if you found out in my next novel that George Washington's spy ring still existed this very day? And the guy in Homeland Security said to me, what makes you think it doesn't? And I said, that's it. That's the plot I want for my book. So the plot for The Inner Circle is simple. George Washington's spy ring still exists to this very day. A young archivist in the National Archives finds out about it, and the greatest secret of the presidency is about to be revealed.
This is the interesting moral dilemma posed in your new novel. We know from The Inner Circle that the president, Orson Wallace, is a bad man, a murderer. And yet he holds the office of the presidency, which every American is told to respect. So there is that conflict. You have a bad man as president and someone's after him, and yet the hero feels compelled to save him.
Yeah, no, and you can read The Fifth Assassin on its own. Like you can, it's a standalone fine, but when you read them together, you see the full moral dilemma, right? Is the main hero hates the president. The president hates him and wants to kill him. And here he is, an assassin's coming, and do you protect someone who you hate? What would you do? And that's what, you know, there's that moment that's, to me, the most important moment in the book where, you know, Beecher says, where they say to him flat out, would you save him? If that bullet is coming, you hate the man. You've spent all your time trying to take this bad president down. Are you really going to save him, or are you kind of rooting for the bad guy? Hmm. And that's what Beecher, for his grown-up moment in this book, has to decide.
It's funny, you talked about Washington's spy ring. It's called the Cooper ring.
Yep.
And I've seen that in other places. A major character in Brian K. Vaughan's graphic novel says Why the Last Man belongs to the Cooper ring too.
Yeah.
Though she's an African American.
Yes, she is. Well, the Cooper ring doesn't exist. It's funny, when I was writing The Inner Circle, Brian's a dear friend of mine. And so I called him up and I said, listen, I'm doing this book and you have this woman here. I just want to make sure. And he said, go with it. Go with God. I'm not doing anything with her. I never wrote about the culprit. He just wanted this African-American character, 355. So what he does is just use her. I was far more interested in actually the machinations of how that thing exists. So I do not have a 355. He has 355.
Well, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with best-selling novelist Brad Meltzer. I'm Ara Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. I'm Ara Gonzalez, and this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is best-selling novelist Brad Meltzer, whose latest thriller, The Fifth Assassin, is about an attempt on a fictional president's life. At the beginning of your new novel, we learn that the president's best friend, a doctor, Dr. Palmiotti, has faked his death and has gone into hiding. A similar situation took place in your novel, The Book of Fate. There, the president's chief of staff fakes his death and goes into hiding. These men fake their deaths out of loyalty to their presidents. You find this type in government and business, don't you? Toadies who delude themselves into believing that they're members of a great man's family, but they usually learn too late that they're expendable.
Yeah, no, I look at that and immediately think, gosh, I'm ripping myself off terribly in each book. But the truth is, it's a truth of every president and every modern president. When I started looking at presidents and when I researched the books, I want to show you what – I don't just go – you know, a president is the easiest character to write a cliche of. All you got to do is have people run around and say, yes, Mr. President, no, Mr. President. And it's just – that's not how it is. It doesn't work like that. And what you see in the real White House when you go there is every president has one thing in common. It's amazing when it comes to staff. They all bring one of their best friends with them. And you saw it, you know, George H.W. Bush brought one of his best friends, made him his doctor, which is actually where Palmiotti comes from. It was based on the fact that Bush brought and said, I want my personal doctor here so I have someone to talk to. He's not, you know, that's a really amazing move. And, you know, Reagan brought people he knew, and Bill Clinton brought people he knew. Bruce Lindsay was one of his best friends from Little Rock. W brought people he knew, his best friends from Texas. And of course, Obama does today from Chicago. But what that means is, and it makes, let's just say, complete logical sense, right? If you're going to be the president of the United States, it means thousands of people are politically gunning for you. You want somebody in that White House that you know has your back, right? If you got elected tomorrow, wouldn't you want to take your best friend and be like, listen, man, just watch everyone, watch all my staff because I don't know these people, and make sure no one's stabbing me in the back. And what you find out over and over and over again when I saw that over and over is that it also means to me that there's someone in the White House who also knows the president's darkest secret, because that is also your best friend. They may love you. They may never turn on you. But they were also – the reason you're their best friend is because you can trust them, and that means they saw something somewhere. I'm not saying every president's a murderer and, you know, their best friend's saving it. But in a thriller, that I stole it from reality.
Uh-huh. A major character in your previous novel, The Book of Fate, Nico Hadrian, is a psychopath who attempted to kill the president. Instead of prison, he's sent to St. Elizabeth's Hospital, a real hospital in Washington, D.C. Nico appears again in The Inner Circle and in The Fifth Assassin. You seem to like this character. Why?
Nico is the first character I've ever brought back. And he's, right, he's a killer who wants to kill the president. And he's crazy. He talks to whoever his last victim was. So he literally spends the book talking to the dead first lady who he kills in one of the books. And he's one of my favorite characters I've done. I don't think people realize – everyone thinks the story is about Beecher, and I don't think people realize that the story is also about Nico. And he is just a character that I find fascinating. He's a character that I just feel – I understand. I know that sounds silly that I understand the craziest man in the whole book, but I do think Nico speaks one of the truest things that's in all the books, and he says it actually in two of the books in different spots, where he says that the mistakes we make in our lives – or mistakes we're going to make over and over and over again. And you don't get out of the cycle of making them until you affirmatively try to break them. And I do think that's what life is about. I look at my own personal life and the moments where I look back and say, man, I wish I wouldn't have done that. It's always the same dumb mistake for the same selfish ego reason. And it's my lesson. I have to learn it. So if you actually look at Nico, there is more truth coming out of the lunatic's mouth than I think anyone realizes.
We're speaking with Brad Meltzer about his new novel, The Fifth Assassin. Reading your novel, I sensed this was a much more personal book. than some of your other books, because one thing I noticed was that all the major characters have father issues.
Mm.
They're all doing something. They're reacting or acting because of their fathers. And does this have some sort of autobiographical connection?
You know, it's funny. When you put out your first novel, you get your reviews, you take your reviews. Your second novel comes out, you get your reviews, you take your reviews. When my third novel came out, people start reading three of them and they start seeing you, right? They start looking at the whole body of work. And when my third novel came out, someone wrote to me on the internet through our website and said, Brad, I've read three of your books now. What are your issues with your father? And none of the books were about fathers. None of them. Fathers were totally in the background, but someone pulled it out. And I think the truth is as you said, there's, you know, show me a novel and I'll show you what the author's dealing with at the time. My father was dying when this book was being written, and he passed away 2 years ago almost. And that was when I started this book. And no question, even before that, when my mom passed away, this is what I was dealing with. It was my own father issues. And I think I stopped being scared of writing about them. I finally got old enough where I just said, you know what? Why am I hiding it? Embrace what I need to embrace the most, and you'll get the most honest work out of it. I just wouldn't have done that when I was 27 years old. I couldn't have done it. I wouldn't have even talked about it. If you asked me on the air, I would have said, oh, no. I just love writing these things. But the truth is these characters saved me from more therapy than you realize. And this is when you finish a book, you look at the first draft and you start saying, okay, I know what I put in there. What did I put in that I didn't even realize I was putting in? And when I looked at the first draft of The Fifth Assassin, I went, oh, I get it. Beecher's growing up. That's what this book is about. And of course he's growing up. I had no choice but for this book to be about growing up. My parents were gone. There's no choice but for The Fifth Assassin to be about growing up.
In your acknowledgments, you write that former President George H.W. Bush helped you with the research. How?
Years ago, former President Bush Sr., the dad, H.W. Bush, was kind enough to write me a fan letter, the best fan letter I think I've ever gotten in my life, saying he liked one of my novels called The Millionaires. And would I sign a copy for him? And I was like, sir, you know, you're the leader of the free world. I'll send you a free book. You know, you get a free book for that. And the truth was, we just became friendly, and he's helped me with research on the past three books. Listen, this is a book about a serial killer imitating the presidential assassins from Booth to Oswald, right? I can make up whatever I want. But we all know that there are only a few people on this entire planet who know what it's like to live in the White House and know that someone's out there trying to kill them. And so I went to him and I just said, can I ask you about this? And he's been kind enough and honest enough to answer the questions. He just likes the novels, and I respect him very much for his trust, and I take that trust seriously. And his answers helped inform how my president reacts when that scene comes, and how everyone should be really reacting when that scene comes.
We're speaking with Brad Meltzer about his new novel, The Fifth Assassin. Is there an underground tunnel at Camp David?
Camp David. So I will tell you, I've done novels where I've done the secret tunnels below the White House. I've done the labyrinth below the U.S. Capitol. The hardest place I ever had to get into were the secret tunnels in Florida under Disney World. Mickey and Donald and Goofy are nice, but if you cross them, they will make your family disappear in the middle of the night, right? So, but the impenetrable place has been Camp David, and I didn't even know what Camp David was. I know the peace accords were signed there, but what really happens there? And it's really a president's playground. They can play golf, they can skeet shoot, they can, you know, and there's no press. So yes, one of the things I found there is really a tunnel that exists that runs under Camp David. It is real. Where you see it is really where it is. I don't want to ruin chapter, I think it's 97 of the book. But you read chapter 97 of The Fifth Assassin, you'll see where the secret tunnel comes out.
You also write comic books. You've contributed storylines to the Justice League of America, Superman, Batman, and the Green Arrow. Superhero movies are immensely popular. Last year, the top three movies were The Avengers, The Dark Knight Rises, The Amazing Spider-Man. This year, the trend continues. Man of Steel, The Wolverine, Thor 2, Iron Man 3, it just keeps going. Why do these characters have such a grip on us?
I think this is not now. This has always happened through history. If you look at the heroes that were popular during the Great Depression, they were Tarzan and they were Flash Gordon. They were characters that, listen, it was called, you know, the Great Depression. People wanted to be elsewhere. They wanted escapist literature. And so they wanted to be in the 25th century or in the jungles. And then World War II starts encroaching on our shores and we're scared. Americans are scared. They're terrified. And what comes to save us? A big bright red and basically blue flag, a character named Superman. And Superman takes off and sells more than anyone. Why? Because we're scared and we want someone to come save us. And if you look after 9/11, When they said there'll be no irony, there'll be no humor anymore, the very first book and movie, I should say, that broke through the public consciousness was Spider-Man. And people forget that. And why? Because we were terrified again as a nation. And I think since 9/11 up until now, we are still that nation that's terrified about someone coming to get us. We want someone to save us. That person is a different person. It's not a Superman anymore. It's a complex Spider-Man. We're a little more vulnerable. And I think that that is absolutely where we are as a planet. I think it's why the Avengers is much more human. I think we do not see ourselves as indestructible anymore. But I think you see over and over that look at any major headline, we are a country still starving for heroes.
But there's been a lot of criticism about the last 20 years of comic books that have been very – the so-called dark age.
Yeah, I know. People always say grim and gritty, and Alan Moore made it grim and gritty. And, you know, the truth is it's just a trend. I mean, what happens is Alan Moore writes a beautiful, wonderful, complex book called The Watchmen. And then the reason – it's not that grim and gritty becomes cool. It's just that everyone wants to rip off The Watchmen. And they think that the ripoff of that is therefore make things grim and gritty. You know, I have people who said to me that, you know, you can look at lots of comics. But I think those trends, truthfully, are a little overstated. I think it's not about – I think it's just about people trying to figure out what sells.
Well, thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Brad Meltzer.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. He also reviews books in the Miami Herald. And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page for author and book links, discussions, photos, and more. We also have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Tomorrow's program is with longtime Florida raconteur and journalist Jeff Klinkenberg. He loves to write about the funky aspects of the state, and there's plenty of material. Now the calendar. On this day in 1919, 94 years ago, the birth of Heloise Bowles in Waco, Texas. Her household advice column, Hints from Heloise, ran for decades in 600 newspapers nationwide. And on this day in 1941, 72 years ago, New York Yankee Joe DiMaggio starts a consecutive game hitting streak which captivates the nation and lasts 56 games until July 17th. The Clipper led the Yanks to 9 titles in 13 years. Where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio? One more before we do it my way. On this day in 1998, 15 years ago, the death of Francis Albert Sinatra, arguably the most acclaimed entertainer of the 20th century. He came to fame with the swing bands of Harry James and Tommy Dorsey. The chairman of the board was 82. Martin Scorsese will make a film biopic of his life. Our final thought from Old Blue Eyes. He won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor in 1953. Quote, "Hell hath no fury like a hustler with a literary agent." Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.